When you think about delegating, right, the power of delegation is that you are giving the people that you lead and manage autonomy. And if you're growing really fast, you always have a lot of cash coming in.
Yeah.
And you're always generating more cash in the next month than you did the month before. And that can hide a lot of problems. I felt like since I was the owner, I had to have all the answers. Because I felt like I had to have all the answers, I didn't let anything go. And so I became my worst enemy. And so people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And if you don't believe that, drive by a Chick-fil-A any day of the week but Sunday and ask yourself, why are there 40 cars in line to buy a boiled chicken sandwich when you can get the same sandwich at Wendy's for half the price? It's not the sandwich, it's the Chick-fil-A experience. But I firmly believe, having lived through some challenging economic times, having been through COVID as an EOS implementer, and now facing all of this uncertainty, that the way you get through it is you execute.
All right, everyone, welcome to The Show Goes On. This is a podcast about the people who keep businesses running behind the scenes. Today, I'm joined by Leonard Linsky. And Leonard is a certified EOS implementer. He scaled multiple businesses, one to 10 million in 21 months and another to 32 million. And now he helps founders and leadership teams get clear, align, and get stuff done. Leonard, thanks for being here today. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. I'm excited. This is a topic I'm really passionate about.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate you being here today. And we got a chance to talk a little bit before, and I want to get into that. But first, I just want to ask you, when people ask you what you do, how do you usually answer?
I help using the tools and disciplines of EOS, which is based on a book, Traction by Gino Wickman. I help teams create clarity and discipline around goal setting and execution.
Okay. What led you to that? How did that all get started for you?
Personal experience. I am a pharmacist by training, and I have started and or bought and sold 5 pharmacies over my 30-year entrepreneurial journey. 4 of them successfully, 1 of them not so much. The last one that we started, all of them have been family businesses, either my wife or my wife and daughter, and usually both, my oldest daughter. The last one we started, we fell into a unique niche and went from $2 million to $32 million in revenue in just under 4 years, which sounds really awesome on the golf course or at a dinner party. But I'm a visionary, which means I'm a really low fact finder and really high quick start, or I'm willing to take a lot of risk. I'm sort of the poster child of here, hold my beer. And so in 2011, on $32 million in revenue, our controller had embezzled $270,000.
Oh my God.
We were 50 days behind with our primary wholesaler. I was $7 million in debt. I lost $2 million on $32 million in revenue. And we had created competition where none had existed. And I had no idea what to do. So I was in a CEO peer group called Vistage. And I was always kind of the flavor of the month because I was a hot mess. And one of the guys looked at me one day and he said, "You need EOS." And I said, "Well, what's that?" Because that was in like 2012 and it wasn't as well known as it is now. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Well, it's for people like you." Well, I thought he meant stupid. But what he really meant was, you know, it's for people who are pretty good at the widget, or it's for people who have really good companies, but they just don't know how to get it to that next level, right? What levers do I pull? What do I need to do to find that next gear? How do I get everybody aligned on my vision? How are we going to get all of our core processes documented and then executed so that they're moving us in the direction we want to go? How do we get issues off our issues list once and for all? How do I get the right people in the right seats, right? And how do I do all this before I run out of money, or in a way that I can also spend time with my kids? Because, you know, man, for 3 years, my wife thought I had a irritable bowel syndrome because I would sneak away on Saturdays and, you know, I'd be in the restroom for 2 hours. Well, I wasn't sick. I was doing email, but I was trying not to keep her from killing me because I'm working on a Saturday during family time.
Yeah. No, so I totally get that.
We started doing EOS in August 2012 after having lost $2 million. And by December of 2013, we were break even. We had a 8-figure exit at the end of 2016. I took a year off and I started doing this in February of 2018.
Wow. So you led it all the way to exit as well.
We made it all the way to exit.
That's incredible. So, you know, you talked about a niche. I'm so curious, what was that niche that got you from 2 to 32?
We identified there were a group of intellectually and developmentally disabled clients that lived in halfway houses in the state of Texas that were underserved by current pharmacy providers. The medication was expensive and kind of specialized, so you couldn't walk into a CVS and get it. There were large nursing home pharmacies that these, you know, just servicing four people, it was too small. So it was just, we just identified this really unique niche of about, I don't know, there was probably 200 or 300 providers in the state of Texas and maybe 30 or 40,000 people who fit the, were in this market, and nobody was servicing with any sort of consistency or quality. And so we kind of came up with a way to do it, build a better mousetrap, and we kind of cornered the market.
Wow, that's amazing. And being, whenever you're able to like find those niches and latch onto them, it's kind of like then you can just run with it and just go.
Right. Yeah. But be careful what you wish for, as my dad used to say, because you just might get it.
In what way then?
Well, I mean, we grew really quickly. I mean, we were like a little neighborhood pharmacy in Sachse, Texas. We were kind of eking along at $1.5 to $2 million a year. And then all of a sudden it just took off like a hockey stick. Mm-hmm. And we weren't ready.
So what did you do to get ready? I mean, one of the things you talked about was getting EOS, but what types of hires did you have to make? What else did you have to do to take advantage of that hockey stick growth?
Well, so the thing about growth is the problems are sneaky, right? Because if you're growing really fast, you always have a lot of cash coming in.
Yeah.
And you're always generating more cash in the next month than you did the month before. And that can hide a lot of problems. And then as soon as the growth levels off, then you look up and go, uh-oh, right? Because there's all this stuff, like our inventory was too big and our days outstanding was too long. So even though, like if we added 100 patients, I needed $90,000 worth of inventory because at the time it took me 40 days to get paid.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wouldn't start collecting that first 60 until, you know, 40 days. I added the $60,000 worth of patients and I wouldn't get paid with that for 45 days. And then I had to buy another 60 at the beginning of the month. So, I mean, to add 100 patients, it cost me, you know, $100,000. And I didn't understand that because I thought if I had revenue, I had money.
Mm-hmm.
And visionary. I didn't understand how much, you know, people kept saying, oh, you can't grow that fast. You can't afford it. It takes all this money to grow. And I'm like, it doesn't take money to grow. It just takes more patients. Mm-hmm. And then when the growth leveled off, I realized how underwater we really, really were. Because the more we grew, the further behind we got. And so we had to get our financial house in order. And as we grew, you know, we had to add a lot of people. And I didn't hire very well. Because if you came in and I kind of believe whatever you tell me, and if I like you and it's really easy to make me like you because I love everybody. And so I would hire you. And so we didn't have any of the right people in the right seats. And we didn't have any process. You could call my customer service number. We had 8 people in customer service and you could ask a question. And on a good day, you could get 6 different answers.
Wow.
Not radically different, but if you're a customer, it'd kind of piss you off.
Yeah.
So, you know, we didn't know how to solve our issues. We kept having these reoccurring issues come up. I didn't know how to get all the moving parts and the pieces in the business kind of coordinated and moving in the same direction. We didn't have a clear vision that people could execute against and use to make great decisions. And I think that the thing that was the hardest thing for me to give up was I felt like since I was the owner, I had to have all the answers. Mm-hmm. Because I felt like I had to have all the answers, I didn't let anything go. And so I became my worst enemy. The biggest problem we had with growing the business was me, because I couldn't get out of my own way, because I didn't know how.
So you talked a little bit about like being able to let go of the vine, right? That's what you coach a lot of CEOs to do as well as yourself in your experience. How do you start with that? How do you start letting go of the vine?
So when you think about delegating, right, the power of delegation is that you are giving the people that you lead and manage autonomy. You're giving them permissions to do their job. And so the most important thing you delegate is the first step, the next step. So when someone comes in your office and says, what do I do? You don't tell them. You say, what would you do? Or have you checked your processes? Or if you're not sure if they know the answer, you say, give me go think about it. Bring me 2 scenarios and let's walk through which one is the best one. But you don't want to do it for them. So what we teach people is that you get a piece of paper, you put it on your desk, and you write down all the tasks that you do all day long for about a week or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put them into one or four quadrants. If you think about a box of four square, right? So yeah. In the upper left quadrant, that's things I'm great at that I love doing, your unique ability. In the upper right quadrant, that's things I like doing and I'm good at. That's mastery. Mm-hmm. In the bottom left corner is things I hate doing, but I'm good at. And unfortunately, that's where most workers spend the vast majority of their time. And that is what we call the burnout quadrant. This is also the never mind, I'll do it myself quadrant, which, by the way, is the five most dangerous words in an entrepreneurial organization is never mind, I'll just do it myself. Yeah. And the reason that people, and then the fourth quadrant is the guilt quadrant. It's the jobs that you do that you hate doing, that you're not very good at, but they're such nasty jobs that you feel guilty about asking someone else to do. And then as you start thinking about delegating, there's actually four questions you should ask yourself. Number one, is the task that I'm doing, does it still create value? Should I still be doing it, right? You see this a lot in multi-generational companies. Well, that's the way dad did it. And so we're still doing it that way 40 years later. Somebody really needs to be looking at that. The second question you need to ask yourself is, can I automate it, right? So the example I always like to use for automation is rules on your email. So rather than looking at 200 emails a day, use rules and filter it so that you're only looking at the 20 most important. The third question you should ask yourself is, can I outsource it? Is there a who for that, right? Is there someone that you could hire fractionally, part-time, 1099, that could do this one task that is really, really good at it, so that it gives you, frees up your time to focus on the things that you're really good at, those upper-level quadrant things. And then if those three answers are no, then the next question is, who do I delegate it to? And you have to, and delegating is not abdicating. And this is why people struggle with it. Because when you delegate, you got to train people and they're going to ask you questions and they're not going to do it your way. And it's going to be slow and it's going to be clunky. And oh my word, it's just this 10-minute project. And never mind, I'll just do it myself. Mm-hmm. But the problem is 5-10 minute projects a day is a week a year.
Yeah.
And when you don't delegate, there's three real costs to not delegating. And then this is a real soapbox of mine. So I'll share this and I'll stop.
No, you're good.
There's three real costs to delegating, right? One is, if you're a $50 an hour employee doing $15 an hour work, there's that $35 delta. And I would argue that's probably the cheapest of the cost to your organization. The second one is, and way more expensive, is if you're doing that $15 an hour task, what are you not doing in quadrant one or two? It could be creating value for the organization. And I think the most expensive one is that when you're not delegating, what you're saying to the people that you're leading and managing is that you don't value them. You don't trust them. And so your A players want to work. They want to help. They want to be doing the job you hired them to do. And by you doing it for them, they either, you train them to not take responsibility, or they just leave, right? But delegating creates autonomy, and autonomy creates trust, and high trust teams. If you read The Five Dysfunctions of a Team by Patrick Lencioni, the foundation for highly successful, high functioning teams, the building block of that is trust. And so if you're not delegating, you are not creating value. And even more importantly, you are stealing agency from the people that work for you, and your good employee, your bad employees will let you. Your good employees will leave.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Like, for our company, Anywhere Talent, we're always connecting founders and entrepreneurs with EAs that help free up their time. Because mm-hmm. a lot of them are just drowning in emails and calendar, and they need some type of help and support. Because like you had mentioned earlier, if they're not working in their area of genius, it's kind of like the opportunity cost, right? So they can do these tasks. They can do it themselves, no problem. And they could probably do it quite well. But what are you foregoing by doing those tasks?
Yeah. So I got a quick little story on that. When I first started doing what I'm doing, I have an EA that I've had for 7 years. She runs my life. And when in the beginning, I wouldn't let her book my travel, because sometimes I'm in Dallas. So sometimes I like to fly Southwest, and sometimes I want to fly American, and sometimes I wanted to spend the night, and sometimes I wanted to come home on the late flight. And I'm like, you just can't figure that out. You know, I'm really picky. I just don't think you can manage this. And when I first started doing this, I traveled a lot. So I was probably spending, 8 or 10 hours a week messing with my travel schedule. And so finally one day she's like, Leonard, I can do this. And at this point I'd gotten a lot busier. So this I needed this 10 hours because, I mean, I'm at home at 8 o'clock on my computer messing with my travel schedule. She's sitting at home playing with her kids because I'm doing her job. And she's way better at it than I am. I can't tell you the number of times I booked something and then had to pay an extra $500 because I picked the wrong date. I give her 30 minutes of instruction. And I think over the last 5 years, she's maybe made two mistakes. So turns out I'm not that special.
And how much time did you save in that process, right? By spending that 30 minutes with your EA on travel and just training her on your particulars, how much time did you free up for yourself then?
500 hours a year.
Wow.
That's 12 weeks.
Wow.
And 12 weeks allowed me to take on five more clients.
So you were able to generate more revenue just by putting in a little bit of training time with your EA. You're able to free yourself up. And now you're spending more time with clients and generating revenue.
And she loves doing that stuff. So she's doing the stuff she likes and loves and that she's good and great at. And I'm getting to do the stuff that I like and love that I'm good and great at. So really, it's a win-win. You just have to let go of the vine.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I think one of the things you mentioned earlier, putting the right people in the right seat. And so talk to me about like the accountability chart, because that's a big function of EOS, right?
Yeah. So in EOS, we talk about an accountability chart rather than an organizational chart. Organizational charts are vertical in that, you know, I know where I fit the organization and who I report to. We think of accountability charts as horizontal. So think about your organizational chart as a baseball diamond, okay? And so before the ball goes into play, you know every person's position and what their roles and responsibilities are. So really the difference for me in an organizational chart and accountability chart is that you know, everybody knows who owns the really important stuff on first base. If you're on first base and the ball's hit your way, everybody knows what's supposed to happen, right? Did the ball's hit the shortstop or second? Everybody knows. The other thing about an accountability chart, when you think about it like a baseball diamond, right? So before the ball goes into play, everybody knows what position they own and what they're supposed to do when the ball is hit. Once the ball goes into play, everybody starts moving towards the ball, right? So if the ball is a dribbler down the first baseline, first baseman runs in, pitcher goes in to back up the catcher, second moves to first to cover the base, shortstop moves to second. And so everybody knows what they need to do to win the play and to win the game, right? Organizational charts are not flexible like that. And by the way, the reason that people are able to be that flexible is because process helps them know what to do. So that's why process is so important in an organization, because it tells people, the accountability chart tells people what they own, and process lets them move towards the ball so that they can execute on every single play.
I love that analogy of a baseball diamond. I never thought about it that way. I'm a big sports guy, so I totally see that, and I can visualize that a lot better than like the structure and rigid org chart that you usually see nowadays.
Right. Yeah. And I stole that, and I can see the guy. I want to give him credit. I can see his face, but I can't remember his name. But somebody way smarter than me.
So you talked about earlier, like people, process, and profit. I'll just throw a hypothetical out there. Let's say I suck at all three. Which one should I work on first?
If you suck at all three, the very first thing you can do to impact all those is a clear vision.
Yeah.
Right? In the book Drive by Daniel Pink, he talks about creating motivated and engaged employees. And the first thing he talks about is, well, he talks about engagement, right? Through delegation and a clear accountability, clear roles and responsibilities. He talks about tools for mastery, but the one he talks about first is purpose. And so people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And if you don't believe that, drive by a Chick-fil-A any day of the week but Sunday and ask yourself, why are there 40 cars in line to buy a boiled chicken sandwich when you can get the same sandwich at Wendy's for half the price, right? It's not the sandwich, it's the Chick-fil-A experience. And the reason that the Chick-fil-A experience is so powerful is because they have a clear vision. They know who they are as an organization because they have clear core values. They have a clear purpose. I don't know what it is, but my guess would be it's around serving, because they are fanatical about it, right? They have a clear 10-year target or big, hairy, audacious goal, right? Which helps you stop playing whack-a-mole and making decisions just to fix the problem of the moment, but it gives you something to look strategically to look forward to. So you're making decisions towards something. They know who their target customer is. They know why people do business with them, right? What are their uniques? And they have a clear, and then they've got a clear proven process so that people know what to expect every time they pull up Chick-fil-A. They know where they want to be in 3 years. They have a 1-year plan to execute that. I guarantee you, they set They set goals, or what in EOS, what we call rocks or quarterly priorities, to achieve that 1 year plan. And they have a way that they can process issues so they can get them off their issue list once and for all. So a clear vision, I think that if you don't know who you are, you're never going to be able to figure out what you're going to do. And a vision gives you three, what I think of as three superpowers. One is, it's the lens through which you make decisions. Your vision is a clear set of rules that define success for your organization. And so when you're delegating and you're giving people the autonomy to make decisions, the way you know they can make great decisions is they have a clear, they understand what success means for the organization. So if the vision supports the core values, if it supports the purpose, if it is helping us get to our 10-year target or whatever our time horizon goal is, you can't make a wrong decision. And it should be clear enough and simple enough that you can put it on the back, all of that on the back of your business card.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have a clear vision, you have a way to make decisions. And once your vision is clear, when your vision is clear, your decisions are easy. And when your vision is clear, then you can start fixing those other things, because what needs to be fixed first will become glaringly obvious.
Yeah. So essentially it's like starting off with the VTO, right? And making sure that the VTO is perfect.
In EOS terms, that's exactly what it is.
Okay. Yeah. And you broke down a lot of what's on that VTO, like the guarantee, the promise, the 1 year plan, the 3 year plan, all of that. If you don't have that, then you can't make the correct rocks. And then you don't know what people to have. And then,
So, you know, a clear vision with an accountability chart makes it really easy to make sure you've got the right people in the right seats, because right people, you just make sure that their personal behaviors support the behaviors that define the core values. And if they don't, doesn't mean they're bad people, right? Just means they're not a right fit for the organization. You got to love them enough to give them the gift of success in another organization.
Yeah.
And right seat is when you look on the accountability chart, in EOS, in the accountability chart, we identify five roles and respond, the most important roles and responsibility for that seat or that function to be successful. And if you're clear on those five roles, then you know whether or not people can execute against the roles and responsibilities. So clear vision, clear roles and responsibilities, let you get the right people in the right seats. Once you've got a clear vision, the right people, and you've got good data, then the real issues in the organization really start to surface and you can begin to solve those issues once and for all. So when I started EOS in 2012. In 2011, we lost $2 million. And my goal for a year when we started EOS was to have a dollar at the end of the quarter. Not even profit, just cash. So when we started EOS and we're getting ready to set our one-year goals, and when we teach one-year goals, whether you're doing EOS or not, you need to pick 3 to 7 of the most important things you need to do that year to move the company forward. And so my implementer says, you got to pick 3 to 7. And I'm like, dude, I got 100. I needed them all done yesterday. They're all critical. They're all important. And this doing 7 is not going to cut it. That's just crap. And he looked at me and he smiled and he waited and he let me stew in the silence. And then he looked at me and he said, how's that working for you? It turns out not so much, right? Because if you're trying to do everything, you're going to end up doing nothing.
Right.
And so you pick the most important things, and then you set rocks or goals once a quarter to achieve those 3 to 7, as well as some other things that need to get done. And as it turned out, I got the 100 things done, but I got them done in the real order of priority as defined by our vision and by, you know, everything that was going on. But we focused on them, we got them done, and then we moved on to the next ones. And that clarity gave me such stillness. I'm not sure quite, it quieted all of that. We stopped playing whack-a-mole.
Yeah, kind of like that noise, right? Of just like, are we doing the right thing or not?
Yeah, because you know, if it aligns with your vision, you're doing the right thing. There's a great story that James Clear references in Atomic Habits, great book, by the way. And he's talking about the Johnson & Johnson Tylenol scare. And in, I don't remember when it was, but basically Johnson & Johnson figured out pretty quickly that the adulteration that was happening to Tylenol products was happening not in the manufacturing process, but at the store level. And so the decision became, you know, do we mount a PR campaign to try to convince the Tylenol buying public that our products are safe and it's some whack job out there poisoning Tylenol, Or do we pull $100 million worth of product off the shelf? And I mean, $100 million is a lot of money, but 30 years ago, it was really a lot of money. And you would think that this was a decision that would take weeks or days. But the reality is the board sat down, they looked at their core values, and one of their core values was around do no harm. And so in about 15 minutes, they made a $100 million decision, pull all the Tylenol off the shelf.
Wow.
That's the power of a clear vision. And I see this played out day after day after day in all of the companies that I work with that are implementing EOS.
Yeah. So when did you start implementing EOS? Like when did that become something that you transitioned into full time?
I sold my company in 2016, and I went to Detroit and got credentialed in February of 2018. So that's when I started. So I've been doing it about almost seven and a half years. And it's all I do.
Yeah. I'm guessing like it was so instrumental in helping you build your businesses that you said, hey, I would love to do this for other people.
Oh, I got to tell you, I think that I don't know where your belief system is, but I think my 30-year entrepreneurial journey prepared me for this and put me in this path, because it was so using EOS to help me get a grip on my business, pun intended. There's a book in the Traction Library called Get a Grip, to get a grip on my business so that I wasn't playing whack-a-mole management, so that I could manage my business proactively and create a team that I could lean on to help me do that and empower my employees, for all of them to help me create a great business. That it was so life-giving to me that once I sold my business, I knew this is what I wanted to spend the rest of. I knew this was my calling. Mm-hmm. And I'm so passionate about this because I've been on that side of the table. I've done that mailbox dance where you're walking out to the mailbox hoping there's enough checks to cover payroll this week. You know, I've been at the kitchen table at 2 o'clock in the morning looking for the answer in the bottle of a Jack Daniels bottle. And so this gave me peace and sanity. And for me, when we started EOS, that first year we were doing EOS, our revenue was about $30 million. And in order to generate $30 million in revenue, my expenses excluded SG&A, I guess you'd call it, outside of my cost of goods, was about $5.2 million. 2 years later, on the same $30 million book of business, because we intentionally stopped growing because we didn't want to start bringing on more clients until we knew we could handle them. So our goal was to maintain client retention. So on that same $30 million book of business, 2 years later, I executed that same book of business for $3.8 million.
In profit?
No, in cost.
Oh, in SGA. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's $1.4 million in profit.
Wow.
Yeah. Plus there was buy-side pickups that we made. And I mean, I grew my profit from negative to probably nearly over 14%. Most pharmacies are 6.
Wow.
Back then. They're less now.
Yeah. And so like you credit EOS for that, right? Doing the weekly L10s and being able to get into your expenses, having the right people in the right seats, the accountability.
Process.
Yeah.
The processes, having a team I trust, knowing that I could have those hard conversations, those honest conversations that need to be had to get people, you know, back on track. Cause people want to know, people want to be told.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, of course, you have to do it lovingly and respectfully. The only thing you have to do to be an effective leader and manager is you have to authentically care about the people you're leading and managing, right? And there's three ways to affect that, I believe. One is you got to listen to them. And the way to demonstrate that you're listening to them is ask questions. So don't just be listening to hear, but I mean, to respond, but really listen and ask questions. Because when you ask somebody a question, they go, wow, you know, they're hearing me. They're thinking enough of me to listen to what I'm saying, think about it, and formulate a question, right? I mean, it's powerful. The second thing you can do to demonstrate people that you trust them is, or that you care about them and build trust, is delegate. This thing that is important to me, I am delegating to you, and I am trusting you to do that. It is the signature piece of vulnerability is delegation, I believe. And then the third thing that you can do to demonstrate that you care about people and build trust is you got to tell them the truth, even when it's hard, because they want to know. And if they trust you, then when you tell them the truth, they know it comes from a place of caring and they're open to hearing. And if they don't, they're not the right people for your organization.
I love that. So like listening, not with the intention of just responding, but really being able to like engage with and ask the right questions.
Right.
Telling the truth. That's so key.
Yep.
No. What was the third one? There was another one. Listen.
Delegation. Listening, at which the way you demonstrate listening is you're asking questions.
Yeah.
Delegating and telling people the truth.
Yeah. And we talked a lot about delegating already. And, you know, you were telling me earlier about being able to tell the truth. So, like, I would love to hear a story. I think you had mentioned the anecdote that you had about a leader stepping up in front of their team and telling the truth.
Yeah. So I've seen I have tons of examples of this, but the one that was the most recent that really struck me as powerful was I was with the team recently and the owner stood up and he's like, guys, we're losing money. And I'm not telling you to scare you. We've got reserves. So it's not like in crisis mode, but we have got to turn the ship and I can't do it by myself and I need your help. And so we spent the day through processing issues and creating rocks, talking about ways, and the team, I mean, you could see him kind of belly up to the bar because he trusted them enough to tell them the truth. And they're all engaged. They're all passionate about what they do. They trust each other. And so rather than him going, I have to handle this myself, I have to hide everything, he's like, we aren't profitable and we need to turn this ship. And so what are we going to do in the next 90 days? And so we processed these issues. We had hard conversations and they came away with three or four rocks around some sales initiatives that they could undertake to generate some additional sales. They came away with two or three rocks around some cost-cutting activities that they were going to undertake. The ones that I really liked was not so much more sales or more cost-cutting, but how do we take our existing resources and leverage them to get to be more efficient or productive, right? So, and there was three or four examples of that. And so at the end of the day, everybody was jazzed and excited and ready to go because they all could play a part. They all bought into the vision. They knew how to make great decisions. They put an issue on the table. They solved it for the greater good. They left their egos at the door. And I think they're going to come out of this in no more than 2 quarters.
Yeah, you know, that's so refreshing, being able to just like a leader being able to step in front of the company and just say, hey, this is what it is. And having a team, like you had mentioned earlier, if they're the right people, they'll want to step up to the challenge and they'll want to help out and make that happen for the company.
Not only how refreshing, how liberating. I don't have to have all the answers.
Yeah.
Right? I can go to people that are smarter than me and say, hey, I don't know anything about, Adobe, but how do we make Adobe more efficient for us, right? Do we have too many licenses? Do we have the right people using the equipment? Do we have the right licenses? Is this a product we're even still using? Because they're growing pretty fast. And so they change, you know, stuff changes all the time. So they may have a litany of licenses laying around that they're not using anymore. Mm-hmm. But the question around how do we maximize the use of the tool that's something that I would never ask, right? That came from the team. That came from the IT I don't remember what department it was, whoever led that department. And, you know, then the finance person is like, hey, there's three or four big expenditures that we've not put out for bid lately. So let's see if we can find a little money there. And, you know, they had a couple of clients that were there. They had a little bit of AR that was lagging. And so, you know, the finance person's like, all right, we're going to get my team to kind of step up and let's see if we can get some of this old AR to generate cash. But it didn't come from the leader. It came from the people sitting around the table. That is freeing. So now he can go home. He knows he's in capable hands. And so when he's sitting at the dinner table with his wife and his family, he can be 100% fully engaged, knowing that he's got people around him that care as much about it as he does. And that while it doesn't go away, but he can leave it at work, go home, be with his family, and then he can go back to work the next day and continue working the plan that they created together as a group. Man, that is power.
Yeah, that's liberating, right? Being
that's
able to
liberating. Go home
and have that dinner and knowing that you have people around you that care just as much.
Yeah.
I love that. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world right now, right? Like the tariffs, potential recession. I don't even know if we're in one. AI. What are some of the challenges that you've been hearing from CEOs in, let's say, like the past 6 months?
You know, it's interesting. AI is something that people are leaning into because I believe it's going to prove to be a powerful tool. I think the challenge there is around figuring out how to leverage it in a meaningful way. People are worried about the tariffs and the economy. But I'll tell you, when I think about the issue list of the teams that I work with, the stuff that keeps coming up is training. How do we train our people in an effective manner so that they are prepared? So, you know, are we giving them the right resources, which is training and time and attention and the right technology and the right people? And the right people isn't enough people. It's making sure that as a leader and a manager, you got to make sure that you got the right people in the right seats. They align with the core values and they're good at their job. Because if you're letting bad team members linger, then you're not servicing yourself or your team or your organization well. So it's training, it's communication, it's usually something around delegating. I mean, it's people. Look, the economy is going to be the economy. You can't control that. And what I found is teams that do really good in difficult times do the little things well. They focus on what they can control. So my issue lists are universal, and you know there are a handful of issues that never change in good times or bad times. But I firmly believe, having lived through some challenging economic times, having been through COVID as an EOS implementer, and now facing all of this uncertainty, that the way you get through it is you execute. You focus on the little things. You do the little things right, and the big things will take care of themselves. The other thing is, I think you have to have the right mindset. The Chinese symbol for danger or for crisis has two meanings. One is danger and one is opportunity. And I think that when you're in these uncertain times, as leaders of organizations, you need to have your head on a swivel for opportunity. Because if you're looking forward, if you're executing and you're doing all the little things well, there will be companies out there who will struggle. And it poses a real opportunity for you to take market share or to begin getting ready to take market share when things start turning around, or to buy a competitor or find a new market or find a market to get out of and exploit a market that we're sort of dabbling in, but that we should be. I saw this so many times in COVID. Companies would laser focus on one or two things that they did really well and get rid of all the noise of things that they weren't doing well, and they flourished. Or they would, you know, pivot and go a different direction. And so I think that there's always going to be issues. They're almost always going to be around people, process, and profit. The economy is a season. It comes and goes. It's real. But I think that if you focus on doing the little things well, keep looking forward and have a clear vision so that you're able to make really hard decisions quickly and with clarity, I think that is your path forward in good times and in bad.
Yeah, I love that. Executing, you know, focusing on the small things, and then all the opportunities, they'll be ahead of you.
Right. You don't win the World Series in the bottom of the seventh or the bottom of the ninth of game seven with a grand slam. You win the World Series on the first game of the season because you're down on one knee with two hands fielding ground balls. And you do that consistently all season long. You play the basics.
Yeah, yeah. Man, having that laser focus execution consistently is so much more important than trying to go for the home run. You know,
yeah.
So, are you a big baseball fan?
Yeah,
yeah.
I guess you could tell.
Who's your team? Yeah, yeah. Because you talked about the diamond earlier, and then you were just talking about baseball right now. So, who's your team?
Texas Rangers.
Oh yeah, let's go.
Well, it was great a couple of years ago.
I'm just glad we got at least one World Series, right? That was amazing.
Yeah, they got our World Series, and this year we have three of the top 10 pitchers in major leagues. Mm-hmm. Man, our bats, we don't have any offense, so.
But that was like a strength of ours like a couple of years ago when we won.
It was, but things change.
Yeah, it changes quick, right?
Yep.
You know, I actually had a chance to go to, I was traveling in Houston, and I had a chance to go to game seven of the ALCS when it was the Astros and the Rangers. And I don't know if you remember that game, but we killed them that game.
Yeah, I remember.
We had won the first two in Houston, lost the next three in Dallas, and then I think we had won the last two or something like that, or won the last one. Yeah, but that was it was so much fun just being in Houston. I think it's Minute Maid, that's what it's called.
Yeah,
being there amongst all the Houston fans when the Rangers were killing them, I was just like trolling everyone. It was so much fun.
Yeah,
but I'm glad we got at least one. You know, I love to think about, I've heard this analogy before about companies are less like a family and more like a sports team. Have you heard that before?
Yes, and I completely agree.
Okay, so talk to me about that. How do companies function more? I mean, that's been traditionally what people have talked about. They've said, oh, you know, we're one big family. And recently I've noticed that the tenor has changed. It's gone from family to more of like a team, a sports team. So yeah, talk to us a little bit about
that. You know, I love companies that they love their employees enough that they want to feel like families. My caution around that is that as leaders, it's really easy to suffer from what I call the nice disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, oh, John, you know, that thing was due today. Oh, you didn't get it done. Well, I know you're busy, so let's just take another week, right? Or, man, I really need to delegate this to Judy, but look at her desk. I can't put one more thing on her, right? Even though it's her thing to do. And so I'll just do it myself, right? So well-meaning, but can be detrimental. Sports teams, you're either producing or you're gone. And that sounds draconian, and I don't mean it that draconian, because while they if they if a player starts struggling, then they have coaches and they have mentors and they provide extra resources to help them get better. But at some point, families, your family, you're stuck forever. Sports teams, they're either going to get coached up or there has to be a change, right? Because we have to win. We have to keep the team moving forward. And so I love the concept and the idea that you know, team members are family members, because I think it comes from a place of love, but I think it can create a little bit of the nice disease. And I think that teams that, you know, love their people enough to have hard conversations with them, because we need to be executing to win for ourselves, for each other, and for the organization, I think that's a healthier environment. And then, you know, and you're spending time coaching and mentoring and helping people get better, or helping them find a place where they will be successful.
And you're one of the people who plays that role as that coach, as that mentor to the leadership team, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's amazing work. And it's just, everything kind of comes together. You have the data, which is essentially like the scorecard or the scoreboard for the team. And they're able to look up at the scoreboard frequently and know how well they're playing.
Yeah, and it's a predictor of success.
So if you don't mind, I want to end with a couple of rapid fire questions for you.
Okay.
Favorite book?
My favorite book is Five Dysfunctions of a Team.
Okay. Yeah. Classic, classic.
Yep.
You said you travel a lot. So what's your favorite city that you go to that you're like, oh man, I can't get enough of the city?
New Orleans.
New Orleans.
Great
Fun.
food.
Yeah.
Great food, great people.
The French Quarter. It's nice.
Nah, not so much the French Quarter,
You like the
but
French Quarter? Yeah.
I mean, you know, I did when I was 20, but I like, oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant Bourbon Street. No, love the French Quarter.
That's why I was like, huh, French Quarter is
Yeah.
like the
No,
nicer.
I was thinking Bourbon Street. I did that when I was 20. Love the French Quarter, love Uptown, Warehouse District. I just love the city. People are wonderful, such a rich history, amazing food.
Yeah, for sure. And I agree with you. I can't even handle Bourbon Street anymore. I'm like, oh no, I'm good. And what's your favorite movie?
Shawshank Redemption.
Great one.
Anytime that comes on, I don't care what I'm doing, I'll sit down and watch it.
Yeah. What's that famous line? You're either getting busy living, you're getting busy dying, right?
Yep, love that.
Well, hey, thanks so much for joining today, Leonard. I really appreciate your time. Before we sign off, is there anything else that you want to share?
You know, just if you're interested in if you are a business owner and you know, of a company that's 10 to 250 people and you want to get better, right? EOS is not typically for companies that are, it is designed for companies that are good and just want to get better. And you're open, honest, and vulnerable, and you're willing to hold that mirror up to your face and have those hard conversations and, you know, literally change the way you run your business so that your business is better. And for me, and for all of us who are EOS implementers, a better business is one that you're running rather than it running you, and that you're growing profitably rather than just top line. And so if you're not getting that and you need to, I would encourage you to look into EOS and find an implementer in your area. I'm always available to have a conversation. My email is Leonard, Leonard dot Linsky, Linsky at EOS Worldwide. Or you can find me on the web or on LinkedIn.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much. I love that last line about being able to hold up the mirror. I think that's so important. And usually it starts with evaluating yourself and how well you're running things.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah. This is
Cool.
incredible. Thank you so much, Leonard. And we'll see you again next time.